thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
Good evening, church. Tonight's Bible reading is Joshua 4, 1 to 7. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever."
Thanks, Emily. And good evening again. It's good to have you here tonight. Trust that you're enjoying this series in Joshua. We'll have a look at that passage in just a minute. Let me just make a couple of brief comments, though, before we do. Matt mentioned the National Church Life Survey, which is what the NCLS stands for, and said, all jokes aside, we'd love you to do it. And let me reiterate that we would love you to do it. It's an opportunity for you to have a bit of a say into kind of how we're going as a church, but also to contribute to the wider discussion of the church across Australia. Really quite significant. So there are some forms there. We had about, 20 of them filled out this morning by people who weren't here. So really take up that opportunity. It did help that I offered free coffees if you did the survey. So we may have had people who did it twice or three times by the end of the day. I don't know. But that's happening. Jodine, who you just got to at least see, is our associate pastor. She started 3 weeks ago. This is her second Sunday night with us. Do you still have your little whiteboard? She has her whiteboard, so she's still looking to get to know you, so make sure you introduce yourself to her. She'll write your name on the board, hold it in front of you, take a picture, and then she can remember who you are, so I know that she would appreciate that in particular. Just a reminder that even though we are filming tonight, and it does feel a little bit weird, I want to remind you again that our main game is not about putting things on film. It's actually about learning to follow Jesus ourselves. So even though it feels a little bit strange and it might still feel a little bit awkward from time to time, really encourage you to keep that kind of in our focus, that what we want to hear is the word of God for us tonight out of this passage in Joshua chapter 3 and 4. So if you have your Bibles with you, I'd encourage you to turn to that at this point in time. I don't know if you've ever thought about how many photos are taken every single day on digital devices all over the world. I grew up in a time when you actually had to buy film in little canisters, and if you were feeling really brave or really kind of luxurious, you might buy one or two rolls of film and take them on a holiday, and you'd take all the pictures and hope for some that weren't blurry or grainy. Nowadays, of course, there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of photos taken of nearly everything. And yet, we still know that there are photos of everything, and then there are those photos that, as my eldest daughter says, are Instagram worthy. The ones that are a step ahead, that we can actually post with a clever caption and a funny little hashtag, that other people will be able to see an insight into our lives. And it just struck me how significant photographs are for us. I mean, they've always been fairly important since their invention, but they just hold such a key role for us in terms of how we keep up with people. So you might have friends or family members who do not live close to you, and you might follow them on Instagram or Facebook, and so you kind of keep track of their life through Instagram or through Facebook. You find out what they were doing, or at least what they were eating, or at least where they were eating from the things that they might post. And it got me thinking a little bit about Joshua chapter 3 and 4. And if Joshua had an Instagram account, what photos would he have taken of this event, of the events that took place in chapters 3 and 4? And part of the reason that I got thinking about that is because the story is a little bit hard to follow. I mean, you get the basic gist of it. The people of Israel started on the east side of the Jordan, and by the end of the day, were on the west side of the Jordan. And the reason that they were able to cross is because the Lord stopped the flow of water, and they kind of walked through. That's the guts of the story. But as it's told, it kind of goes forward and backwards and fits and starts, and it keeps kind of crossing back over previous territory. It's just kind of a funny story to read. It's not written how we might write it. And so I thought, well, maybe we can talk about some of the images, some of the key scenes in this that would help us kind of be a little bit more visual for us and kind of help us grasp the story as a whole. But before I do that, let me just kind of point out that the story does not contain what I think we ought to expect the story to contain. The story is that the people start in the east and end up on the west side of the Jordan. We kind of get, well, there you go. That's what they were trying to do. They were trying to get into the promised land, except this is not, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, this is not a group of refugees hoping that they will be accepted when they kind of cross over the Jordan. This is not a group of nomads who have happened to find a big stretch of open, empty territory where they can actually begin to live. This is an army of conquest. They are about to enter into the land of Canaan and forcibly take the land from its inhabitants. That's what they're aiming to do. Now, I'm not a military strategist by any stretch of the imagination, but it would appear to me that if I were a Canaanite and I saw the Israelite army on the east side of the Jordan getting closer, that I would want to stop them establishing a bridgehead on the western side of the Jordan. You kind of expect the first incursion into the promised land to be a battle. I was talking to someone this morning who's been in the military, and he was going to talk to me through the significance of establishing a bridgehead into enemy territory, and just pointed out that it's a really vulnerable situation in time. If you don't have really strong lines of communication and supplies and all of those things, you can get destroyed by an enemy fairly quickly, and yet there's absolutely nothing about the military strategy here in chapters 3 and 4. There's one lonely little reference to people armed for battle leading the people of Israel out. But apart from that, there's no discussion. The Lord doesn't say, listen, I want you to start digging trenches and establish a beachhead there and look out for their archers and be careful of the iron chariots. None of that sort of stuff. Joshua isn't concerned to establish some sort of strategic place. There's no conversation about their logistics or communication or any of that sort of stuff. In fact, it reads a whole lot like a very religious event, almost a little religious parade of some sort with almost no bearing on the battles to come. Now, interestingly, can I just point out that by the end of chapter 4, we are 1/6 of the way through the book of Joshua, this book about conquest, and absolutely nothing has been conquered. Not a single battle has been fought. And that ought to remind us that what we're dealing with here is not, strictly speaking, some sort of historical record about battles. There's something more significant underneath it. And I think this story begins to kind of point us in the right direction. So let me come back to the story itself and give you some of the images that I think Joshua might have posted on his Instagram feed had he had one and we were following him on the day that they crossed the Jordan River. Then the very first image that you would have seen at the end of the day as you kind of scrolled through and saw what Joshua had been up to would have been a photo of four men holding on their shoulders a box that was suspended by two poles. They would have been the four Levitical priests, and they would have been holding the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was a golden box that had two angels on top of it, wrought in gold, who has outstretched wings kind of almost touched each other and covered what was known as the mercy seat. It was to some degree the portable throne of God. When God had to go out and about, he went in the Ark of the Covenant, if I can put it that way. And because the Lord was kind of on or in or around or with the Ark of the Covenant, you couldn't just pick it up by hand. And so it had specially designed rings that these poles went through and four men would carry it. And I think Joshua would have picked this photo as kind of the start of the day to kind of take a snap of the four men holding the Ark of the Covenant, because the whole scene revolves around what happens. Because as these four men make their way down to the Jordan River, as soon as their sandals touch the water, the flow of the Jordan stops. And the water gets heaped up in a big pile upstream, and downstream there's just nothing. And the priests carry the ark into the very middle of the river, or what was formerly the river, and stop there on dry ground. This is a fairly amazing photo, a wonderful photo opportunity for Joshua and for the people of Israel. But this is a significant moment. The people of Israel are to give the Ark of the Covenant a wide berth. They're to make sure they maintain their distance from the Holy God. And they're also to consecrate themselves the day before. And consecration was preparing yourself for something sacred, making sure that you were ready for something quite significant. And the last time the people of Israel were to consecrate themselves was in relationship to receiving the law at Mount Sinai, when there was also a boundary around the mountain that the people were not to transgress. So what we learn right off the bat is the Ark of the Covenant is involved, the presence of God is there, and God is about to do something quite remarkable that the people are to be prepared for. No mention of swords, no mention of archers, just be prepared for God to do something remarkable. Well, if Joshua had been amongst the first to kind of cross over and then turn back from the western bank and kind of looked back, I think his second photo would have actually been of the Transjordan tribes. We mentioned these guys a couple of weeks ago. They're the tribe of Gad and Reuben and half the tribe of Manasseh, who had basically asked if they could live on the eastern side of the Jordan. And Moses had said, that's fine, as long as you come over on the western side and help us defeat the various Canaanites and Amorites and whatnot, and then when that's done, you can go back. And so we're told that the Transjordan tribes led the people across the Jordan. I reckon that Joshua, standing on the western bank, would have got a nice photo of that and kind of said something about the promise being fulfilled or hashtag faithful, I don't know, something clever, right? And then he probably would have taken a panorama, because it would have been quite an extraordinary scene. On the one side, the far side of the photograph, there would have been this huge pile of water, which is just an interesting thing to say, a pile of water. Not snow, not ice, a pile of water, kind of getting bigger all the time, I suppose. Then there would have been people flowing across, pardon the pun, across the dry riverbed. And they would have been kind of coming in this big line, and then they would have spread out around this empty pocket in the very middle of the stream bed where the priests were standing with the Ark of the Covenant, and then down to more people, and eventually just the dry riverbed kind of fading out into the distance. It would have been fairly remarkable. This is kind of the heart of the story, the Ark of the Covenant in the very middle of all that is taking place, the presence of God. And this reminds us, of course, a little bit of the Red Sea crossing, which is the definitive kind of the standard, the gold standard act of God's salvation. The people of Israel were coming out of Egypt. They were being pursued by Pharaoh and his army. And God parted the Red Sea, and they walked through on dry ground. And when Pharaoh and his army followed, the waters flowed back over them, and they were drowned and destroyed. This is a little bit different. No one's chasing them, but it reminds us of that great act of salvation. And it's actually linked to something else in the story. These events, we're told in chapter 4, take place on the 10th day of the first month. That was the day that preparations began for the Passover. And the Passover was a memorial. It was a ceremony that they remembered, a meal that they remembered what God had done. And so as the people are beginning to prepare for the Passover, they are entering through the Jordan River, reminded of the time they held the first Passover and fled out of Egypt and were miraculously rescued by the Lord as well. This is a fairly significant moment for them. The fourth photo, I think we're up to four now, would have been of 12 burly men. I'm assuming they're burly because Joshua says, go to the middle of the Jordan and pick up 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel, and put it on your shoulder. Now, I can imagine that he probably wanted the biggest possible rock that a man could carry. So you can picture these 12 burly blokes, one from each of the tribes, right? Mud on their togas or whatever they were wearing, beats me what they were wearing, right? Great big rock on his one shoulder, another guy kind of holding it like some sort of barrel, another guy having it in front of himself, all kind of smiling at these big, smooth, water-smooth stones that they had pulled from the very middle of the dry riverbed. And then the last photo that I think that Joshua would have taken on the day, and the one that eventually would have been framed and hung in his office in Timnath-Serah when he finally settled down, would have been of the memorial as it was finished. Because he took these 12 stones, and when they camped for the evening, he piled them up in a great big pile. And that memorial was meant to be a sign for the people of Israel. And all the way through this, I think you're seeing that this is not really a military text, is it? It's a religious one. I mean, the Ark of the Covenant, which is the presence of God, goes into the waters. There's this kind of this miraculous drying up of the riverbed. The people cross over in miraculous circumstances. It's linked with their previous salvation out of Egypt and linked with the Passover. There's all of these sorts of things going on. In fact, even the significance of the crossing itself is linked to religious things. So if you have a look in chapter 3, in verse 7, the Lord gives us the reasons for the crossing. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses." So this miraculous crossing, I mean, they could have built the bridge. They could have crossed on rafts or on boats that they had created. But no, the Lord stops the water to exalt Joshua so that the people would always follow him. And then when Joshua speaks to the people in verse 9, he says, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. This is a sign for you that God is with you." And yes, there's language of the fact that, yes, he's powerful enough to drive the nations out, but there's something quite significant about the event itself to point to God. And the memorial that is set up also has a religious reason for it. Again, if you have a look in verse 6 of chapter 4, Joshua says, "This will serve as a sign among you." It's a sign. It's a memorial of what God has done. "That the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial forever." And at the end of the chapter, he says the same thing. "When people ask about these stones, tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God." It's a religious reason at the end, isn't it? The reason God dried up the Jordan, the reason why they took these stones, the reason why they piled them up was so that the people of Israel might fear the Lord. And the fear of the Lord, as I've talked about before, is about a deep respect for the things of God. I've used the example before of my mentor. I suppose, in the biblical language, I could say that I fear my mentor. Not because he's a frightening individual or scary, thundering at me in some sort of kind of godlike fashion, but I hold him in such high respect and regard that what he suggests, I will just about always do. I hold him in such high respect and high regard that if he says I would do X and I was thinking about doing Y, I will seriously rethink doing Y. Because of the respect I hold for him. To some degree, the people of Israel are to hold the Lord in that kind of respect, in such high regard that when the Lord calls them to live a certain way, that they will live a certain way. When he calls them to be obedient, that they will obey, because they hold him in such high regard that they can't imagine not doing what he's had to say. This is a religious moment. This is a religious passage. It's a religious text. It does raise the question for us, though. You know, this memorial was meant to remind the people of Israel of what God had done. How do you remember what God has done in your life? It's tricky, isn't it? It's a lot harder to take a picture of it. Sometimes because what God has done in our life is really big and it's hard to connect ourselves to it. You know, we know that we have hope for the future, but how do I connect my life to that? Sometimes it's because the work of God is only recognized retrospectively. We don't see what God's doing in the moment. It's only when we look back after months or weeks or years, and then we look back and we go, oh, look what God has done. And we kind of miss the opportunity to kind of take note of that. And sometimes it's for the simple reason that what God does in our lives is not quite as concrete as parting a river. I mean, if you know, you wander down to the river and it parted in front of you and you picked up a rock from where you couldn't have picked up a rock before, that would be a really concrete reminder of what God had done. Often what God does in our lives is just a little bit harder to put our finger on. This memorial is meant to remind the people. And it's important that we remember, because our memory tends to be as short as the people of Israel. But the memorial actually serves another purpose. The memorial is not just to remind the people of what God has done. It's actually designed to invite questions. Twice, Joshua says in verse 6 and then again in verse 21, I believe, he says, when your children ask, what do these stones mean? When the next generation asks their parents, what do these stones mean? Then tell them. Now, you might have some conversation pieces in your house. Perhaps if you've traveled someplace more exotic than Miranda, you've bought something and you've placed it in a relatively prominent location, people can say, oh, where did you get that? Or you might have some of your kind of greatest Instagram photos and you've selected one or two and you've actually taken one and you've framed it because it's a wonderful location or you're with particularly special people or whatever it might be. And people are in your house and they say, oh, who's in the photo with you? Or where's that photo taken or whatever it might be? And you start a bit of a conversation. I have a couple of photos in my office. I should have a photo of my family, but I know what they look like, so I don't. I've got a photo of my soccer team, the W14As that I coached down at Georges River, and I have a photo of myself with Paul Henderson, a relatively famous hockey player. And every so often, people make the foolish mistake of asking me about who's the fellow in the photo with me. And 45 minutes later, they're sorry they asked, because I tell them the story. And not only about why Paul Henderson is so great, but also why I got to spend a day with him and what a wonderful experience that was. If you ever have 45 minutes spare, come along to my office and ask the question. It's designed to some degree to help me remember a special moment in my life. And it's also, though, an opportunity that invites questions. And these things work together, don't they? I mean, imagine some young Israelite boy walking with his father as they walk down the road past Gilgal years and years and years later. And the young son says to his dad, Dad, what's with the pile of rocks? And his dad says, well, son, those stones are piled up from the Jordan River. The boy says, oh, what, from the bank? Oh, no, from the very middle of the river. Oh, Dad, that's impossible. How do you get stones when the water's flowing like that? Ah, well, son, the Lord can completely stop the water. The Ark of the Covenant came down, and this is when Joshua was leading us, and he ordered 12 men, one from each of the tribes of Israel, to take one of the stones from the very middle of the stream bed, and we've piled it up there. It's not just the memory, though. Because imagine, and this is not that hard to imagine, because the people of Israel struggled to be faithful. Imagine if that young boy with the innocence and honesty of a child were then to look at his dad and say, so Dad, why don't we worship the Lord? He sounds pretty awesome. Able to stop the river to allow his people to come through. That's pretty remarkable. Why do we worship these other gods? Why do we worship the gods of the Canaanites? Why don't we just worship the Lord? Do you see how the sign, the memory, and the invitation to questions work together? In the New Testament, we see something quite similar. In 1 Peter, in chapter 3, there's a relatively famous little verse. You may have heard it. It says this in chapter 3, verse 15. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. You might be familiar with that. Always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. But the context of that verse is actually quite intriguing because Peter says this just before it. He says, who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for doing what is right, you are blessed. And then he says, always be prepared to give an answer. And it seems to me that those two things are connected, aren't they? Because what in that context are people going to ask about? They're going to ask, why are you okay when you suffer for doing the right thing? And all the way through this letter, it talks about this kind of Christ-centered life that's just very different. Slaves, submit to your masters. Wives, submit to your husbands. Suffer for doing the right thing. When someone does something bad to you, repay it with good. All of these things that demand something of us, so that people might ask a question. And if someone had asked someone who had just read Peter, so why is it that you are willing to suffer for doing the right thing? Why is that? I think their answer would have come from chapter 2. where in verse 9, Peter says these words, Old Testament words about the people he's writing to. He says, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. There's this combination of remembering who they were, remembering what God had done in calling them, in giving them purpose, in giving them a mission, in adopting them, in bringing them into light, remembering what God has done and then living in such a way that it invites questions. And the question for us is your life a memorial? Is your life organized around remembering the things that God has done? Are your attitudes and actions, the things you say and don't say, the things that you value and the things that you don't, are they wrapped around what God has done? Because when you allow that to shape your life, then you become a memorial that is going to invite questions. Why do you do the things you do? Why do you value the things you value? Why do you say the things you say? And when they ask, tell them. Tell them. Well, I do those things because I'm in a relationship with God through his son, Jesus Christ. It might take different form. It might sound very different than that, but tell them what God has done. Point to what he has done. Be reminded of what he has done. See, again, the big deal for Joshua and the people of Israel was not the walls of Jericho, or the alliances of the Amorite kings. It was about faithfulness to God. Faithfulness to God. About lives that reflected what God had done in their lives in such a visible way that it invited questions. And this memorial, this pile of stones taken from the middle of the Jordan River, becomes a symbol for what their lives and our lives ought to be today. So I want to leave you with that. I ask you to consider, how do you remember what God's done? How do you wrap your life around that? And are you living your life in such a way that people are going to ask some questions? And when they do, be prepared to tell them.